Chapter 8. Nathaniel. The afternoon's council meeting was even less satisfactory than John Mandrake had feared. It took place in the Hall of Statues at Westminster, a rectangular room built of pink-grey stone, with soaring medieval vaulting high above, and thickly layered Persian rugs covering the flagstones. In a dozen niches along the walls stood life-size statues of the great magicians of the past. There at the end, austere and forbidding, was Gladstone. Opposite him, flamboyant in a frock-coat, his deadly rival Disraeli. All the succeeding prime ministers were featured, together with other notables. Not every alcove yet contained a statue, but Mr. Devereux, the current premier, had ordered the empty ones to be filled with sumptuous floral displays. It was guessed the vacant spaces reminded him of his own mortality. Globes of imp-light drifted against the ceiling, illuminating, in the centre of the room, a circular table of English oak, broad in diameter and polished to perfection by labouring imps. Around this sat the council, the great ones of the empire, toying with their pens and bottles of mineral water. Mr. Devereux had chosen a round table for reasons of diplomacy. Technically, no one person took precedence over another. An admirable policy, which had been undermined by his insistence on using a gigantic golden chair, ornately carved with swollen cherubs. Mr. Mortensen, the War Minister, had followed suit with an ostentatious seat of burnished redwood. Not to be outdone, Mr. Collins of the Home Office had responded with a monumental throne of emerald brocade, complete with perfumed tassels. So it went. Only John Mandrake and his erstwhile master, Ms. Jessica Whitwell, had resisted the temptation to somehow modify their seating. The placing of each magician's chair was likewise subtly fought over, until the situation had stabilized to reflect the factions that were opening up in council. Mr. Devereux's two favourites sat beside him, John Mandrake, the Information Minister, and Jane Farrar of the police. Beyond Farrar sat Ms. Whitwell and Mr. Collins, who were known to be sceptical about the direction of the war. Beyond Mandrake were Mr. Mortensen and Ms. Malbindi of the Foreign Office. It was their policies that the government was currently following. The meeting began inauspiciously with an advertisement. From a side room a giant crystal orb came rumbling on a wheeled platform. It was pulled by a slave gang of implets, led by a foliot overseer, wielding a horsehair whip. As they drew near the table, the foliot uttered a cry, the implets sprang to attention, and with the cracking of the whip vanished, one after the other, in clouds of coloured steam. The crystal orb glowed pink, then orange. In its centre appeared a broad and beaming face, which winked and spoke. "Esteemed ladies and gentlemen of the council, let me remind you that we are only 2 days from the theatrical event of the decade, the society event of the year. Reserve your tickets now for the premiere of my latest work, based on the life of our beloved friend and leader, Mr. Rupert Devereux. Get ready to laugh, cry, tap your feet, and sing along to the choruses of From Wapping to Westminster, A Political Odyssey. Bring your partners, bring your friends, and don't forget your handkerchiefs. I, Quentin Makepeace, promise you all a sensational night." The face faded, the orb went dark. The assembled ministers coughed and shuffled in their seats. "Dear God," someone whispered, "it's a musical." Mr. Devereux beamed around at them. "Quentin's sweet gesture is a mite unnecessary," he said. "I'm sure you all already have your tickets." So they had. There was little option. The day's business commenced. Mr. Mortensen gave a report of the latest news from America, brought by gin across the ocean. It was sour fare. Deadlock in the wilderness, minor skirmishes, nothing decisive gained. It had been so for weeks. John Mandrake barely listened. The account was predictable and depressing. It only increased the frustration that boiled within him. Everything was out of control. The war, the commoners, the situation across the Empire? Something decisive needed to be done, and soon, if the nation was to be saved. And he knew what that something was. The staff of Gladstone, a weapon of incredible power, lay useless in the vaults below that very chamber, begging to be brought out by anyone with the talent to use it. If wielded effectively, it would destroy the rebels, cow Britain's enemies, send the commoners scampering back to work. But it needed a magician of the strongest level to command it, and Devereux was not that man. Hence, out of fear for his own position, he kept it safely locked away. Would Mandrake have been able to use the staff, given the opportunity? In all honesty, he didn't know. Perhaps. He was the strongest magician in the room, with the possible exception of Whitwell. Then again, 3 years before, when he had acquired the staff on the government's behalf, he had tried to get it working and had failed. That knowledge, that frustrated ambition, mixed with self-doubt, contributed to the listlessness which had lately come over him. Day to day his job was futile. He was surrounded by squabbling fools, unable to improve the situation. The only glimmer of hope came from the hunt for the traitor Hopkins. Perhaps there he could make a breakthrough, achieve something tangible for once. Well, he would have to see what Bartimaeus found. Mortensen droned on. Overcome by boredom, Mandrake made desultory notes on his pad. He sipped his water. He appraised his fellow council members one by one. First, the Prime Minister. His hair streaked with grey, his face puffy and blotched with the strain of war. A heaviness hung about him. He seemed tentative and quavering in speech. Only when discussing theatre would a trace of his old animation return, the infectious charisma that had so inspired Mandrake as a boy. At other times he was dangerously vindictive. Not long before, Mr. Collins's predecessor in the Home Office, a woman named Harknett, had spoken out against his policies. 6 haulers had come for her that evening. Such events troubled Mandrake. It did not suggest the clear thinking worthy of a leader. Besides, it was morally unsound. Beyond Devereux sat Jane Farrar. Sensing his appraisal, she looked up and smiled. Her eyes were conspiratorial. As he watched, she scribbled something on a piece of paper and pushed it across to him. It read, "Hopkins, any news?" He shook his head, mouthed, "Too soon," made a rueful face, and turned his eyes to her neighbour. The Security Minister, Jessica Whitwell, had endured several years out of favour. Now she was steadily clawing it back. The reason was simple. She was too powerful to be ignored. She lived frugally, did not attempt to accumulate great wealth, and devoted her energies to enhancing the security services. A number of recent raids had been annihilated, thanks to her efforts. She was still bone-thin, her hair ghost-white and spiky. She and Mandrake regarded each other with respectful loathing. To her left, Mr. Collins, the newest member of the council. He was a fiery little man, swarthy, round-faced, eyes habitually bright with indignation. He had repeatedly emphasized the damage the wars were doing to the economy. Prudently, however, he had stopped short of overtly demanding an end to hostilities. On Mandrake's right was the war faction. First, Helen Malbindi, foreign minister. She was by nature meek and malleable, but the pressure of her current post had made her prone to outbursts of shrieking rage among her staff. Her nose was a good indicator of her mood. At times of stress it went white and bloodless. Mandrake held her in low esteem. Carl Mortensen, the War Minister, stood beyond Malbindi, rounding up his report. For years his star had been in the ascendant. It had been he who most strongly advocated war upon America, he whose strategies had been most closely followed. His lank blonde hair remained long. He had not deigned to crop it into military style, and he still spoke confidently of success. Nevertheless, his nails were bitten to the quick, and the other council members watched him with the steady eyes of vultures. "I remind you all that we must remain committed," he said. "It is a crucial time. The rebels are running ragged. By contrast, we have barely tested our resources. We could maintain our presence there for at least another year." In his golden chair, Mr. Devereux ran a finger across a cherub's rump. He spoke softly. "A further year would not see you in this room, Carl." He smiled up under hooded lids. "Unless you were incorporated into some kind of ornament." Mr. Collins tittered. Miss Farrar smiled icily. Mandrake inspected his pentop. Mr. Mortensen had blanched, but held the Prime Minister's gaze. "We will not need a year, of course. I use the term for illustration only."
"A year, 6 months, 6 weeks, it is all one." Miss Whitwell was speaking angrily. "In the meantime, our enemies across the world are taking advantage of us. There is talk of rebellion everywhere. The Empire is in ferment."
Mortensen made a face. "You overstate this." Devereux sighed. "What is your report, Jessica?" She bowed stiffly.
"Thank you, Rupert. Only last night, 3 separate attacks occurred on our own soil. My men destroyed a Dutch raiding party off the Norfolk coast, while Collins's gin had to repel an air attack over Southampton. We assume they were Spanish demons, do we not, Bruce?"
Mr. Collins nodded.
"They wore yellow and orange tabards, decorated with the arms of Aragon. They sent infernos raining down upon the city centre. Meanwhile, another band of demons savaged a section of Kent," Ms. Whitwell continued. "I believe Mr. Mandrake dealt with that." She sniffed.
"I did," John Mandrake said blandly. "The enemy force was destroyed, but we have no evidence where they came from."
"A pity."
Whitwell's thin white fingers tapped a rhythm on the table.
"Even so, the problem is clear. This is a European-wide phenomenon, and our main forces are not on hand to crush it."
Mr. Devereux nodded wearily.
"Indeed, indeed. Does anyone else fancy a sweetmeat at this moment?"
He looked around.
"No. Then I shall venture one alone."
He coughed. A tall grey shadow stepped from nowhere around his chair, and with spectral fingers laid a golden tray before him. It was piled high with yellow pies and pastries. The shadow withdrew. Devereux selected a glazed doughnut.
"Ah, excellent. Jane, pray give us the police's perspective on the domestic situation."
Miss Farrar adopted a languid pose, but nevertheless displayed her figure to fine advantage.
"Frankly, it is troubling. Not only do we have these raids, which are hard to deal with, but there is the matter of commoner disruption. More and more people are seemingly resistant to magical attacks. They see through illusions, observe our spies. Inspired by their example, strikes and demonstrations have been held. I regard this as potentially more important even than the war."
The Prime Minister wiped fragments of sugar from his mouth.
"Jane, Jane, we must not get distracted. Commoners can be dealt with in due time. They are restless because of the war."
He looked meaningfully at Mr. Mortensen. Miss Farrar inclined her head. A strand of hair fell attractively across her face.
"It is your decision, of course, sir."
Mr. Devereux slapped a hand against his thigh.
"It certainly is. And I decide that we shall now have a little break. Coffee and sweetmeats all round."
The shadow returned. With varying degrees of reluctance, the ministers accepted their refreshments. Mandrake slouched over his cup, looking at Jane Farrar again. It was true that they were allies in council. Distrusted by the others, favoured by Devereux, they had long been thrown together. But that meant little. Such allegiances could change at the drop of a hat. As always, he found it hard to resolve her strong personal allure with the cool flintiness of her personality. He frowned. It was a curious fact that despite his self-control, despite his belief in the virtues of magician's rule, viewing someone like Farrar close up made him feel deep down uncertain, hesitant, clouded by unease. Still, she was very beautiful. When it came down to it, of course, all the council made him feel uneasy. It had taken all his inner steel to maintain his status in their company. They each radiated ambition, strength, cleverness, and guile. None of them ever acted against their own interests. To survive, he had done the same. Well, perhaps this was the natural way. Had he ever met anyone who had acted otherwise? Unbidden, the face of Kitty Jones came into his mind. Ridiculous. A traitor. Violent, tempestuous, untamed. He made a doodle in his pad. A face with long dark hair. Ridiculous. Anyway, the girl was dead. He crossed it out hurriedly. And further back, long, long ago now, there had been his art tutor, too, Miss Lutyens. Funny, he could no longer clearly recall her face. "Didn't you hear me, John?" That was Devereux, speaking almost in his ear. He felt little flakes of sugar doughnut being blown against his cheek. "We are discussing our position in Europe. I was requesting your opinion." Mandrake sat up. "Sorry, sir. My agents tell me there is discontent as far afield as Italy. There have been riots in Rome, I understand, but it is not my area." Gaunt, severe, stick-thin, the security minister, Jessica Whitwell, spoke. "But it is mine. Italy, France, Spain, the Low Countries, everywhere it is the same. Our troops are at an all-time low. What is the result? Dissent, riot, rebellion. All Europe is erupting. Every last malcontent under the sun is preparing to strike at us. We will be fighting in a dozen countries before the month is out."
"This is no time for exaggeration, Jessica."
Mr. Mortensen's eyes were steely.
"Exaggeration?"
A bony hand slammed against the table. Miss Whitwell stood.
"This will be the worst uprising since 1914. And where are our forces? Thousands of miles away. I am telling you, we will lose Europe if we are not careful."
Now Mortensen was raising his voice, too. He half rose from his chair.
"Oh, and perhaps you have a solution, do you?"
"Certainly I do. We pull out from America and bring our forces home."
"What?"
Mortensen turned to the Prime Minister, face dark with fury.
"Do you hear that, Rupert? That is nothing but rank appeasement. It borders on treachery."
A blue-grey glow erupted around Jessica Whitwell's clenched fist. The air hummed with a surge of unearthly force. Her voice was suddenly quiet.
"Would you be so good as to repeat that, Carl?"
The War Minister remained rigid, fingers locked around the armrests of his redwood chair, eyes flicking to and fro. At last he sank back into a position of furious repose. The glow upon Miss Whitwell's fist flickered and went out. She waited a few seconds more, then sat with victorious care. According to their allegiance, the other ministers smirked or scowled. Mr. Devereux studied his cuticles. He looked a little bored. John Mandrake stood up. Affiliated to neither Mortensen nor Whitwell, he felt a sudden urge to wrest back the initiative, to take a gamble, throw off his inertia.
"I'm sure neither of our excellent ministers intended to give offence, nor were so childish as to receive it," he said. "Clearly both are in the right. Jessica's anxiety is prudent, since the situation in Europe is becoming unfortunate. Carl's refusal to admit defeat is also laudable. We cannot leave America in the hands of criminals. I would like to suggest a solution to the problem."
"Which is?"
Miss Whitwell was unimpressed.
"Withdrawing troops is not the answer," Mandrake went on, coldly. "That sends out quite the wrong message to our enemies worldwide. But we must bring this conflict to an end. Our demons are not enough, and nor, saving Mr. Mortensen's pardon, are the common soldiers. We need a decisive weapon that the Americans do not have, something with which they cannot contend. Simple. We use Gladstone's staff."
He had expected the barrage of noise that greeted his proposal. He did not attempt to speak further, but with a thin smile sat himself down.
Jane Farrar met his gaze and raised a quizzical eyebrow. The faces of the others were variously indignant.
"Impossible!
A foolish fancy!
Quite out of the question!"
The noise subsided. Mandrake stirred.
"I'm sorry," he said, "but I don't quite understand your objections."
Carl Mortensen made a dismissive gesture.
"The staff is untried, untested."
"It is hard to control,"
Helen Malbindi said.
"A highly dangerous artifact," Jessica Whitwell added.
"But that's the point," Mandrake said. "With the staff, Gladstone conquered Europe. It will do the same to Boston easily enough. Our friends in Paris and Rome will hear about it and duck down behind their parapets again. Problem solved. Once it has crossed the ocean, the whole thing would take no more than a week. Why keep the staff under lock and key when it's the solution to our difficulties?"
"Because," a cold voice said, "I do not choose to use it. And my word goes."
Mandrake turned to face the Prime Minister, who had swiveled in his chair and drawn himself upright. Devereux's face had become hard and lined, the flabbiness less obvious. The eyes were dull, opaque.
"You may, perhaps, have received a memo this morning, Mandrake," he said. "The staff, and other items, have been removed to the Room of Treasures in this very building. They are surrounded by a range of high-level magical safeguards. They will not be used. Do you understand?"
Mandrake hesitated. He thought of standing his ground. Then he remembered the fate of Ms. Harknett.
"Of course, sir," he began. "But I must ask why—"
"Must? You must do nothing."
The face was suddenly twisted, contorted, the eyes wild and staring.
"You will know your place, and not seek to destabilize this council with your inane theories. Now be silent and think before you speak again. And be careful lest I suspect you of having an agenda of your own."
The Prime Minister turned away.
"Mortensen, bring out the maps. Give us a firmer update on our position. I understand we have pinned the rebels in an area of marshland."
"That was a little rash,"
Jane Farrar whispered, as she walked with Mandrake in the corridor an hour later.
"Whoever has the staff holds true power. Devereux's frightened of what that person will do to him."
Mandrake nodded sullenly. The depression he had briefly shaken off had speedily returned.
"I know. But someone's got to make the case openly and clearly. The country's falling into chaos. I wouldn't be surprised if half the council aren't planning something. Concentrate on the plot we do know about. Anything yet on Jenkins?"
"Not yet, but it won't be long. My best gin is on the case."